This podcast is produced on the land of the Cammeraygal people. We'd like to pay our respects to elders, past and present, and acknowledge the thousands of years of storytelling on this land. This episode also contains references to war and mentions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have passed away. It's 1942, and we're in a small town called Broome on the lands of the Yawu people on the northwest coast of Western Australia. The summer heat is still clinging to the early days of autumn. The wet season is about to begin. The sunshine is reflecting against the clear blue waters of Roebuck Bay and sizzling the red sand of the shore. 15 flying boats carrying evacuees from the former Dutch East Indies are moored at the bay for a pit stop to refuel and resupply. Soon they will continue their journey south. Now, if you don't remember your school history lessons, that's okay. It's World War II and these Dutch citizens are fleeing the former Dutch East Indies because the Japanese have just won the Battle of the Java Sea. A local young Aboriginal lad, by the name of Charles D'Antoine, is working at the bay.
My uncle, Charlie's job, he went out, he cleaned the boats. His job was to clean the flying boats. And then he waited for the bigger boat to come in with the fuel, and they'd refuel the boats and then they'd continue their journey to either Perth or to Melbourne or Sydney.
This is author Edie Wright, Charles D'Antoine's niece. She has written a book about her Uncle Charlie's experience on this day because, for those in Broome, on the 3rd of March 1942, they could have never imagined what was to come.
And then when he saw the Japanese Mitsubishis, he knew that they were going to be attacked. When he went out, it was just absolute carnage. You know, the water was alight, there was billowing smoke, planes were all on fire, people screaming and yelling in the water. And he knew that if he didn't jump off his boat, you know, that would explode too. So he jumped in, and there was a Dutch lady and her child. Uncle Charlie couldn't speak Dutch, but they managed through sign language. He managed to show her, hang on to my back and hold your baby tightly. Hang on and I'll take you ashore. So, and he was swimming along and there was another little girl. She was about 5 or 6. I don't know the exact age, but she was just in the water. So he picked her up and he put her on his back.
On this day, 88 civilians and allied military personnel were killed. In the eyes of many, Charles D'Antoine was a hero, performing an act of selflessness, risking his own life to make sure others were saved.
But he never, to this day, that I know of, he never got any recognition from the Australian government. It was the Dutch who honoured him and recognised him for what he did.
I'm Paulien Roesink, a journalist and presenter with SBS Dutch. This interview with Edie you're hearing is one I did last year for my program, but it's a story that stuck with me. To Charles D'Antoine's family, rescuing the Dutch was an heroic act. So why is it that the Dutch government honoured this man, while the Australian authorities didn't? This is Uncle Charlie, the Invisible Hero, a podcast from SBS Dutch and NITV Radio. In the next 3 episodes, I'll be speaking to historians, community members, survivors, and family members about what it means to be recognized for heroism, to figure out why Uncle Charlie didn't get officially recognized by the Australian government. To get to the heart of this question, we must ask, what exactly happened on the 3rd of March 1942, when the bay was on fire? I know Uncle Charlie's story. I know what he meant to the Dutch community and what his story means to his family and to the local community. But I wanted to understand what the town of Broome was like before this horrific day.
I came on a 2-year teaching contract. Broome was not unfamiliar to me. I lived as a teenager in the next closest southern town, which is Port Hedland, and I spent a fair bit of my holiday time in Broome and attended one of the first Shinju Matsuris, which is the Festival of the Pearl.
This is Michael Lake, a Broome local since 1980. He calls himself an accidental historian for the Broome Historical Society and Museum.
What started me on the journey was being asked by my dance and drama teacher to write a synopsis on the air raid so they could prepare a performance for the anniversary of the air raid.
And he has been a volunteer guide and researcher for the past 8 years.
Could you describe life in Broome in the early 40s?
Broome was quite a sleepy, small little place. It was quite significant in terms of shell production, mother of pearl. But as the winds of war started to blow, the advantage that Broome had was its geographical location to then the Dutch East Indies. So an air bridge was established initially through Darwin. But then as the war came closer, Darwin came too risky. So the Australian authorities, Aviat, made the decision to make Broome the forward operating base.
This means that Broome became a gateway for people moving south.
And the records show us that about 3 or 4 days before the raid, 5,000 people passed through Broome heading south. Mm. So, yes, it was a very, very busy place. There's a famous comment from one of the Americans who was here helping out with the forward operating base, who he reckoned it was busier than LaGuardia Airport in New York at the time. It was a major logistical exercise, it's just keeping the fuel supply for the aircraft, both the land base and the sea base planes. People were getting on board for various reasons. So there were members of the diplomatic corps left Singapore, other nations, naval attaches, dependents. Everyone was thinking after the Battle of the Java Sea, it was not quite every man or woman for themselves, but it was getting close.
In early 1942, Darwin experienced its first attack of World War II. Japanese forces mounted 2 air raids on Darwin. To this day, the Battle of Darwin was the largest single attack mounted by a foreign power in Australia. With a need for a safe airport between Australia and the Dutch East Indies, Broome was set up as the next air bridge between the regions. It was a safe flight path and just out of range for the Japanese Zero planes.
What Allied intelligence didn't realise, that there was a unit inside the Imperial Naval Air Service of Japan that had been experimenting with long-range fuel tanks, what we would now call drop tanks. And there was this one particular unit of Zeros that had been trialling the technology. And they were headed up by their commander, Shibata. And Shibata had noticed that the radio traffic coming out of Broome had just gone sky high. So he said, something's going on in Broome. So he sent the initial reconnaissance aircraft. The reconnaissance aircraft prior to the raid just showed that there were about 10 to 12 aircraft sitting on the tarmac at the Broome airdrome, but nothing on the bay. So Shibata basically said, right, this is a target that's airlifting material into the Dutch East Indies. It needs to be neutralised. The idea was that they would come, hit the targets that were on the ground here and leave. It was to be a precision raid. The mission commander, when they rounded the Ganthian Point, which is one of the peninsulas in the Broome area, realised that unlike the reconnaissance photos of the day, there was flying boats on the bay. So very quickly, the mission commander, Morano, said, I'll have 3 aircraft and pilots to hit the airdrome, 3 aircraft and pilots to hit the seaplanes that were now had arrived during the night, and 3 to fly top cover, including himself, so that if there were any Allied fighter aircraft, they could be dealt with by those three. So a very classical attack setup, and they went methodically about their work. Now, the issue arises because the seaplanes had arrived during the night and the tides were not correct to get people off the seaplanes. So the ones that arrived in the night still had people on them, and they were doing their best to make themselves comfortable by sitting on the wings and all that sort of thing. The main casualties happened in the bay, and predominantly they were Dutch civilians.
If you look at the map, you can see that the shortest route from Java to Australia is ending in Broome, or not exactly, but Broome was the only place they could reach where they could refuel. They would refuel and then fly south to Port Hedland and on to Perth, Fremantle, and then they were not any longer in range of the Japanese Air Force, so they were supposed to be safe. But they didn't really know that the Japanese fighters had such an extreme long range.
Bas Kreuger is a Dutch historian who has done a lot of research for the Dutch government into what happened in Broome on that third day of March in 1942. I asked him why so many Dutch citizens were in Broome on the day of the air raid.
There were about 15 flying boats in Roebuck Bay in Broome, and they were all coming from the Netherlands East Indies, from Java. And that was because in 27, 28 February, there was the Battle of the Java Sea that was lost by the Allied fleet against the Japanese, and they invaded Java. They brought about 8,000 people from Java back to Australia. On 2 March, the Japanese sent a reconnaissance flying boat from Timor. They had occupied Timor from the Kupang airfield to fly over Broome.
How many people died that day?
It's difficult to say that with any certainty because there were no passenger lists. I think around 80, 85 were killed. Again, we don't know for certain how many. You can count the number of graves, but a lot of people were also died on board of the flying boats that sunk to the bottom of Roebuck Bay. Some were swept away in the currents or, even worse, eaten by sharks. So we don't know with any certainty how many really died that day.
I remember as a six-year-old, it was about sundown.
Theo Doorman was one of the young Dutch passengers on the flying boats.
When we were in the air, it was dark. The crew had prepared some pea soup in an electric pan, and we each got a spoon and could take some soup from the pan. So suddenly there was rattling of machine guns. It appeared that was only to try the guns, whether they worked. My mother and I slept on one of the bunks. In the early morning, at about 7:30, we looked from a porthole and saw below us a sort of bay, and we came down and landed.
I asked Theo why he was leaving the Dutch East Indies.
My father was a naval officer. He was a rear admiral in 1942 and commander of the combined striking force of the ABDA nations. ABDA stands for American, British, Dutch and Australian. A combined effort to stop the Japanese onslaught that was directed on the oil fields in Indonesia, on Borneo and Sumatra.
Karel Doorman, Theo's father, is an important person in Dutch maritime history. The Dutch Navy named several ships after him, and in the Netherlands, there are plenty of streets and squares that bear Karel Doorman's name.
The final battle, the battle in the Java Sea, was on the 27th of February. In that battle, the Allied ships all went down. From there, they tried to escape via Strait Sunda, but they came smack in the middle of the Japanese landing on West Java. My father stayed on board of his ship when it sank and died there, presumably.
Within days after the Battle of the Java Sea, Theo and his mother traveled to Surabaya, where they got the opportunity to evacuate to Australia.
There were four Catalina flying boats lying in a piece where a river was dammed off and could provide a sort of runway for these flying boats to take off. So in the afternoon of the 2nd of March, we took off there together with other evacuees. We flew to Australia. Everybody was high strung, that's certainly the case.
So, at about 9:30 in the morning in Broome, Theo's flying boat is resting on the calm waters of Roebuck Bay. Some of the passengers are sitting on the wings of the plane, stretching their legs as the plane is getting resupplied and refueled for the next part of the journey.
So my mother stayed with me within the plane in the little luggage she had. She had taken some toys with her. My favorite airplane, which was a sort of metal plane with folding wheels and so on, and some soldiers. And I was alone playing there with my soldiers. And suddenly there was a lot of noise, and I saw a Zero flying close over and rattle, rattle, rattle. My mother came charging in and yanked me to more to the front of the plane under the bunk and started laying on top of me. And next to us, there was a Mr. and Mrs. Kramer. He was a naval officer also. And she had been wounded in the head by a bullet. And then we got a second attack. It was directed at gasoline tanks, which were between the two motors on the top wing. Of course, they burned. My mother again yanked me, and we got to the cockpit. There was one of the hatches was open, so we jumped on the starboard side. First my mother in the water, then myself. So when we jumped in the front of the plane, we were swept by the current under the burning wing. I didn't see my mother anymore, but I saw a curtain of burning gasoline and oil and everything roaring. I was directed by the current, by diving and by swimming sideways. I managed to get out sideways under this flaming thing above my head. But I had lost my mother, and I saw another head. I swam with him, and we swam probably for half an hour, 3/4, and there were patches of water which were steaming hot because of the oil which had burned. Suddenly, an American motorboat came. They took us on board, and after 10 minutes, luckily, my mother was pulled out of the water. In the boat, there were several wounded people. I remember I sat on one of the side seats, and below me was a man with his back that was completely open. Apparently, I felt a sting. I also had a sort of cut above my eye, and my mother took my handkerchief out of my pocket on the right side, and that was soaked with blood. And then they discovered I had this shot.
Did you realize what was going on?
I didn't know much about the whole attack. That photo of Roebuck Bay with all these burning wrecks, with this enormous umbrella of black smoke hanging above it, and me looking at the photo, realizing that I had swam somewhere between the whole thing. And my mother, she eventually was nearly 98 and was a bit hazy and didn't remember very much of it. But one thing she did remember before her death, she had kicked her shoes out, and on bare feet she had to walk on the tarmac, which was steaming hot. It definitely made a large effect on me. People now have a lot about PTSS, my whole life I had, I had nightmares. There are presently three survivors that are still living. We two are there, and there's David Sherp, who was then a baby and held above water by his father, so he didn't drown.
Did you see Josine van Achelen?
No, I met her very much later.
May I ask you how old you are?
September.
I'll be 90 in September.
Oh, so just as old as Mr. Doorman. He will be 90 this month too. Wow, you're a tough woman. You're still so good and can remember everything. Josine was on a flying boat with her parents. Josine's father, Johannes van Achelen, was a sergeant aircraft mechanic on the Catalina Y-59 flying boats. The Naval Air Service got ordered to divert to Australia. Josine and her mother flew with the departing aircraft crews, just like many other families, when the attack happened.
I knew immediately that I no longer had a father and a mother. We were still on the plane, and my father came out of the dome where they were shooting out of. He went two steps down and crouched behind me, and then suddenly, bang, he was gone. And later, my mother probably picked me up because she was helping people exiting the plane. She threw me out too, but I believe she was also injured because normally she could swim. I was holding her, and then she sank away.
For over 70 years, it was a mystery for Josine who saved her life. It wasn't until 10 years ago, when the company Pia Media produced a short documentary about her war story. And in the process of retelling the story, the documentary makers discovered that it was Uncle Charlie who saved her.
It was very brave of him, because there was a lot of oil in the water and it was also burning. And later I had heard that there were also sharks swimming. I'm glad I didn't know that, but maybe they were scared off by the noise or the fire or something like that. I did have a little bit of trauma because I didn't like when people came near me when I was swimming. I had it for a long time, and I had to unlearn it by standing in the shower and putting the shower head on my face. And now I don't suffer from it at all. But it did take a long time.
Earlier we heard from Charles D'Antoine's niece, Edie, who spoke about how he was awarded for his heroism. Uncle Charlie received a letter from Queen Wilhelmina, the Queen of the Netherlands at that time, and an erepenning, a silver medal from the Dutch government. I asked Bas, the historian from earlier, about how often the Dutch were awarding people for brave acts during the war.
There's a list of non-Netherlands people who received medals during the war. For the Broome disaster, there were three medals given out. So a white Australian and an Aboriginal Australian both got the same bronze medal for their work that day. I don't know if that's really special, because I think the Dutch, especially in the Dutch East Indies, had a relationship with Indonesians. So they were maybe looking at it at a little bit different than at that time in Australia.
And as we already know, the Australian government didn't acknowledge Uncle Charlie's actions. Michael from the Broome Historical Society and Museum shares his thoughts about that.
Robert Bay is not a good place to dive, so they're completely obscured. And just two or three of the wrecks get exposed on the very, very low tides. A lot of people went above and beyond that day, and Charlie was one of them. Where Charlie was a bit different is that he certainly didn't get the recognition. I think he should have been exceptionally highly decorated. I think particularly of Andy Islands. He was a radio operator on one of the British aircraft, and he jumped out of the aircraft dinghy and started putting women and children into the dinghy. He not only got a military citation, but he got a civilian citation as well from the British government. So he ended up commander of the British Empire. possibly if it was anybody else, I might have got the George Cross or the equivalent thereof. But I just don't think it suited the political environment of the time.
How does the local community remember him?
He was remembered as being a very quiet man who underplayed how brave he was. It really required others to tell the story. And also, to a certain degree, it wasn't in the government interests of the day to publicise the fact that an Aboriginal person had been so brave. And so I think there was almost a shame factor there. And so the story didn't get the mileage or that it should have. If it had been any other person, the decorations would have been much higher and much more effusive. Charlie was not recognised by the Australian government. It was the Humane Society of Australia gave him a medal. And then it was quintessentially the Dutch government recognised him. It was a story that, you know, wasn't quite swept under the carpet, but it was pretty close to it. As I once heard it from one of his relatives, Uncle Charlie came to join the army, but he had enough action on one day. So he sort of said, I don't think that's the path for me. And I mean, who would blame him? Be caught in the middle of a firefight and then to dive into shark-infested waters rescuing people. And then what people forget is after the living were brought to shore, it then was the rather gruesome task to then recover the dead and give them a quick, decent burial on the foreshore. So Charlie would have done that, and that almost beyond comprehension. Very rarely do any of us of our modern generation have to face that kind of thing, only generally our emergency workers who are called out to the worst situation. And I think that probably was enough for Charlie.
In the next episode, we'll hear from Uncle Charlie's family. They share with us their special memories of him and talk about his heroic efforts.
They didn't acknowledge the efforts of Uncle Charlie, the bravery of Uncle Charlie, because at the time, you know, the policy was that, you know, we were still being assimilated and we were still being seen as subservient type people in Australia, and it just went unrecognised.
It upset him. And he had to get him sitting down and get him to talk about it. Otherwise, he didn't talk about it openly. Only if you sit down and ask them questions.
This is Uncle Charlie, the Invisible Hero, a podcast from SBS Dutch and NITV Radio. I'm your host, Paulien Roesink. The NITV Radio team is Carrie Lee Berry and Nari Pakai. From the SBS Audio podcast team, Joel Suppel, Max Gosford and Bernadette Fung Nam Win, this episode was mixed by Mandy Coolen. Follow this podcast on the SBS Audio app or wherever you get your podcasts.